Howard Lincoln popped up on the screen. Below the portrait of Sega's competitor was a statement that Lincoln had made about Sonic during the Tengen trial. They came up with a darn good game. They're going to be a very strong competitor. After a brief moment of, "Are we allowed to laugh at the silence?" everyone gave in and erupted in laughter. Before the chuckling could dissipate, Nilsson surfed forward on the wave of momentum. "And to help promote our third-party licensees, I'd like you to meet our second new spokesperson." This time, a large photo of Nintendo's Minoru Arakawa popped up, with an equally incriminating quote of his praise for EA's John Madden football for the Sega Genesis. Kalinske noticed Sullivan bending forward to try to contain a bout of belly laughter, and he couldn't help but think back to the baseball analogy from last evening. The perfect game was still in progress, but now he felt like he was headed into the ninth with only the bottom of the order standing in his way. Kalinske had started off day two with an inspiring speech. He'd wanted to get everyone as excited about peeking into Sega's future as he had been a couple of years ago when Nakayama took him to that R&D lab. When Kalinske felt like his words had done the trick, he passed the baton to Burns, who happily bombarded the audience with sales figures and forecasts. More than anyone else, he spoke their language, and there was no translator needed to see how much the retailers liked what he had to say. After Burns described how much there was to be made, it was up to Adair and Nilsson to pull back the curtain and prove that this was possible. Adair spoke first, using Sega's colorful Game Gear as a metaphor to describe everything that Nintendo's black-and-white Game Boy can never be. And then finally, to close the deal, Nilsson took over. Nilsson announced that Sega was dropping the price of the Genesis to $129.95, and then disclosed Sega's war plan for 1992, which consisted of having the hottest games, the hottest promotions, and the hottest advertising backed up by Sega's largest advertising budget ever. Though Kalinske loved a good game as much as the next guy, and took great pride in clever promotions, it was this last bit that excited Kalinske the most. Since bringing on Ed Volkwine, Sega's search for a new ad agency had been narrowed down to five choices, including the front-runner and his personal favorite, Wieden & Kennedy, an Oregon-based firm that had become famous for their work with Nike during the past decade. While Kalinske would readily admit that he missed Steve Race, there was a poetic justice to losing the man behind Reebok and gaining the men behind Nike. Kalinske was thrilled that Wieden & Kennedy had joined the field of competitors, and he was looking forward to watching them win the account next month, when each agency would formally pitch Sega. He knew that a company like Wieden & Kennedy would help him finish Sega's reinvention, and he wanted the new national campaign to veer memorably outside the box. If Sega could do that and also get the retailers on their side, there would be no stopping them. But Kalinske knew that he was getting ahead of himself. One step at a time, he reminded himself. Wind up and pitch. Catch and throw. Finish the perfect game. "After all is said and done," Nilsson said with folksy charm, "what is it that kids want? Great games. It's that simple. And in 1992, we've got the must-have games that kids will be clamoring to buy in your stores." Kalinske nodded to Nilsson, who was controlling the room magnificently. "Starting off our new titles for the second half of 1992 is David Robinson Basketball." Nilsson paused to play a tape featuring some of the gameplay, then glided back into his speech. "We're talking a full-on, full-court running game here, with 24 incredible moves that were digitized from videotapes of real basketball action. David Robinson Basketball includes all the elbow-pumping, board-crashing, ball-stealing excitement the floor can dish out." Nilsson had a fast-talking, strangely enticing style that somehow made it seem like he was making fun of specific games, of video games in general, and even of himself, while simultaneously expressing reverence for all those things, including himself. It was hard to say how he did all this, but he did it well as he continued through the highlights of Sega's upcoming roster. There was Tasmania, which featured 17 levels of postcard-quality Tasmanian scenery, including whirling waterspouts and perilous quicksand. And there was also Evander Holyfield's Real Deal Boxing, a game centered around the fighter who had once knocked out Buster Douglas. "It's 360 degrees of non-stop action in the ring," Nilsson boasted, before moving on to Super Monaco GP2, the ultimate fantasy for anyone who's ever been thrilled by the smell of burning rubber. Batman returns. Holy Batsmoke! It's Batmobile versus Duckmobile as Batman hurls into acrobatic action against the death-dealing Penguin. End Tailspin. You'll circumnavigate the globe while Don Carnage and his air pirates try to thwart your progress. Nilsson was on a roll, and the crowd loved it. Kolinsky most of all. Nilsson was throwing strikes left and right, showing off the full arsenal. Fastball, curveball, slider, even a knuckleball from time to time. In October, we'll be re-releasing some of our previous bestsellers, like Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, under the banner of Sega Classics, and they'll be available to customers at only $29.95. Kolinsky could feel the momentum building. Perfection might be an abstract concept, but it had a specific feeling, and Kolinsky was sure that everyone in the room must have felt it. Then, Nilsson introduced the next game, and something went horribly wrong. In November, he announced, comes a game with the most unusual goal. For the first time ever, you want to die, Nilsson said. Seconds later, the power went out. The air conditioning cut out, the projection screen went black, and though slivers of sunlight trickled through the window shades, the hundreds of retailers who would decide Sega's fate suddenly found themselves in the dark. Chapter 29. After the blackout, but before the surge. Shit. Kolinsky tried hard to think of any word besides this, but it was no use. The world had gone dark right in the middle of Sega's most important presentation. Shit. Shit. After the momentary shock wore off and he realized that this was a power outage, he turned to John Sullivan, whose eyebrow was ominously raised. Shit, shit, shit. Well, Kolinsky said, mining for some kind of silver lining. I guess Sega has become so darn powerful that even the state of Florida can't handle us. Hey, if they're looking at the same sales figures that I have, Sullivan said, slapping Kolinsky on the shoulder, then I wouldn't be surprised. It was then that Kolinsky realized Sullivan's eyebrow had arched not with condemnation, but with curiosity. And he was not alone. There was a wide range of reactions from audience members, including shock, disbelief, and incredulity, but no evident annoyance. If anything, they seemed pleasantly surprised by the turn of events, and happy to have a story to spread around back at the office.
To be completely honest, Tom, Sullivan said with another slap on the shoulder, I figured this was all part of the show. You guys are kind of crazy like that. Good crazy.
Good crazy. Kolinsky liked the sound of that, and gained a further appreciation for the description as Sullivan continued to explain while the club's staff ushered them out of the ballroom and through an equally unlit hallway.
There's a kamikaze-like aggressiveness to everything you guys do. You're not afraid to shake things up,
Sullivan said as he, Kolinsky, and hundreds of other retailers were led out into the parking lot. As long as we're helping to put money in your pocket, Kolinsky said, then I'm a happy man.
You are, Sullivan said. Believe me, you are.
They continued walking beneath the zealous sun until they found a comfortable spot in the shade where they could continue the conversation.
Can I trust you with a story?
Kolinsky nodded and took a half step closer. He had a feeling this would be good.
Okay, Sullivan started. Coming out of this past holiday season, we'd sold a ton of goods. You know this already, I know, but the point is that we sell out of almost everything except some older 8-bit stuff. We ask you to mark down the goods, you guys oblige.
Of course, Kolinsky said. We don't want that stuff taking up your shelf space.
And I thank you for that sentiment, as I did with Electronic Arts when they agreed to mark down some excess inventory we had on hand. But I'm sure you can guess who didn't feel the same way.
It's their policy, Kolinsky said, rolling his eyes. They don't mark down.
Yep, Sullivan continued. So, sometime in January, I'm walking through one of our stores with Charles. Well, there are all these unsold games piled up, and he's not a happy camper. I mean, the man is 70 years old. He's our founder, for God's sake. But Charles Lazarus loves selling more than anything else, so this gets him up in arms. He picks up one of our inventory scanners, checks the SKU, and out pops a sell-through information with the vendor's name. Nintendo. He tells me that I need to get them to budge, and I try, but it's no use.
Not good, Kolinsky said.
When Charles wants something done, believe me, I know. But they're steadfast in saying that it was our problem for not selling the inventory. They refuse to take it back and refund what we paid, and they refuse to let us discount the goods. So, what am I supposed to do?
You're supposed to ask how high, Kalinske said, when Nintendo says jump.
I keep talking to Peter Main and Randy Peritzman, telling these guys that something needs to give. Finally, they agree to come out, and they say they're going to bring Arakawa. I take that as a good sign, since he doesn't travel much. So it's Charles, myself, and Howard Moore, and then Peter, Randy, and Arakawa.
Wow, Kalinske said. Everyone's bringing out the big guns.
A good old-fashioned Mexican standoff, right? Sullivan said. But they're not Mexican. The Japanese, or Arakawa is, at least. So I warned Charles in advance that dealing with them is a little different than he's used to. When the Japanese say yes, it means, yes, I understand, not yes, I agree. So if you tell Mr. Arakawa you want markdown money, he will say yes, but that doesn't mean he's going to give you any dough.
The quirks of Japanese business, Kalinske belted.
Oh, it's slowly becoming the story of my life, and, my friend, it's a horror story if ever there was one.
Not getting along with Nakayama-san?
No, of course I am. It just takes way more time and energy than it ought to.
That sounds about right, Sullivan said.
So they come in, and we go through all the usual pleasantries. I think we even exchange gifts with Arakawa, each giving the other some trinket destined for the garbage someday. Anyway, we get down to business. Charles lays out the importance of a partnership, then cuts to the chase. For this relationship to keep functioning at a high level, things need to start changing around here. There's a long silence, and all eyes go to Arakawa, who finally nods and says, yes. Charles remembers what I told him earlier, so he says, yes?
What kind of yes? Yes, we're going to work together on this, a yes you understand but you don't care.
Can I interrupt for a moment? Kalinske asked. I just want to tell you that I don't even care how the story ends. You've already made my day.
Just wait, Sullivan said with noticeable excitement.
After another long silence, Arakawa once again does that nod and says yes. Charles is starting to get cranky. He keeps asking what's that supposed to mean until Peter finally pipes up and says that it means that what we want is not going to happen.
For the record, you've now made my week.
Sullivan rolls his eyes and continued. So Charles has had enough. He stands up and says, in my mind, this is a partnership. Now you can either try to meet us halfway or this meeting is over. Charles stomps out of the room and doesn't come back. As you might imagine, there's a pretty big awkward silence there. So, we fill the void by going back and forth with niceties. I mean, it's a couple $1 million we're talking about here. That's a lot, but not the end of the world. We don't want to make enemies, so we talk about the wife and kids and send them back to Redmond.
I apologize for interrupting again, Kalinske said, but I would like to amend the record to let you know that you've now made my year.
Oh, yeah? Sullivan said. And I'm about to make your life. After I walk out of the meeting, Charles comes up to me and asks if they've changed their mind. Of course not, I tell him. So he says, fine. Even if they're not going to give us the money, I want you to do the markdown anyway. I tell him that's silly. Now we're not only going to lose money, but we're going to piss them off and remove any incentive they might have to change their mind. But Charles doesn't care. Look, he says, we're going to play a chess game. You might be right, and they may not give us the money. But if we mark down their products, there isn't going to be a single retailer in the marketplace who doesn't think that Nintendo gave us the money to do it. So I do exactly what he wants. And the next day, I get a call from Peter, and he's flipping out. I explain that we're doing the markdown anyway, and that Charles has a message he'd like to pass along. We'll take the loss this time, but we won't ever forget that we did. Well, not long after that, Nintendo agrees to give us the money, and they start a corporate markdown program.
Wow, Kalinske said. Wow, wow, and wow.
I don't know what to say. Say you're welcome, Sullivan replied. And I'll say thanks, because I tell you, that game of chicken doesn't turn out the way it did without Sega in the mix, so thank you, Mr. Kalinske. From myself and Charles.
Since the day you took over, it's been clear to me that Sega wants nothing more than to beat the crap out of Nintendo. And so far, you and your team are doing a damn fine job.
Thanks, John, Kalinske said, genuinely touched. He was overjoyed to hear such unfiltered thoughts. Before today, he had assumed that everything he'd just heard from Sullivan was in fact reality, but there was nothing better than having that perception confirmed straight from the source. And for Kalinske, the best part was Sullivan's acknowledgement of the work done by his team. Almost all of them had been handpicked by Kalinske, Ryo, or Toyota, and thrust into a job they'd never had before. By hook or by crook, but never by the book, they got the job done, and the industry was taking notice. Kalinske looked around the parking lot, now flooded with a mixture of his employees, retailers, and perplexed members of the Boca Raton Club, wondering who turned out the lights. Even in this bizarre moment, he could see that his guys were finally getting the respect they deserved. Nilsson was being congratulated like he just delivered a nation-changing inaugural address. Adair was being treated with the same kindness she always showed to everyone else. And Van Buskirk was telling a story about the Sega LPGA tour event, and naturally drawing in anyone who happened to catch a word. After a month of trying to coordinate this thing, I realize that I'm stuck in the middle between Sega of Japan and the LPGA, she recounted. Only problem is, due to the time difference, whenever Japan's in the office, the LPGA isn't, and vice versa. So, I cut through the bureaucracy and call the tour myself. We get the thing done in a matter of days. Great, right? Or not, Van Buskirk said, and paused briefly to shake her head. Oh, man, someone said, just a random club member cheerfully eavesdropping. This guy knows what I'm talking about, Van Buskirk said with a wink. Anyway, I fly down to this fabulous event with John Carlucci, who helped put this whole deal together, and by the way, runs the best sports marketing company in the business. So, shortly after we arrive, SOJ's best and brightest arrive, and we get summoned to an inquisition. I had no idea what was coming. I don't know if anyone else knew it was coming, but man, we got taken down. We were asked to stand in front of the table. We were not asked to discuss anything. We just got a verbal barrage. You really messed up. You embarrassed us, and this is an abomination to how we do business. We both walked out with our eyes as big as the moon. I've heard of these meetings where the guy in the center is so full of authority. We left the room shaking, literally shaking, I swear. But it wasn't 24 hours later at some dinner event that the same people, the same guy in the center and all of his lieutenants, line up to get their photos taken with me because I'm tall and blonde. Van Buskirk playfully ran a hand through her hair. By the end, it occurs to me that I'm just a blow-up doll to them. Knock me down, deflate me. Heck, even use me to ride in the carpool lane, and then just blow me back up when you need something. Van Buskirk had the crowd surrounding her in stitches, including Kalinske and Sullivan. She's a keeper, Sullivan said. Yep, Kalinske added, watching Van Buskirk transition into another anecdote. Even when the power went out, the presentation was halted and the script had to be tossed out the window. The show went on at Sega. But the thing is, John, Kalinske said, they're all keepers. Otherwise they wouldn't be here, and neither would I. About 10 minutes later, the power came back on, and the parking lot broke out in applause. Kalinske, his employees, and the retailers made their way back into the ballroom to finish the presentation. After everyone took a moment to feast on the glorious invincibility that only air conditioning can provide, there was an overwhelming sense that maybe it would be better to skip the rest of Nilsson's speech and trade in business casual for swimwear. Nilsson could sense this, and he knew he'd have to work to get them to listen to him. Greetings, Nilsson said, readjusting to the stage. Thank you for bearing with us through that pesky disturbance. Unfortunately, we'll never know what caused the blackout, but I can't help think twice now about those rumors that Luigi was spotted earlier today hanging out by one of the generators. The audience laughed, but wasn't yet convinced to sit back down. He claimed to be working on the plumbing, Nilsson explained, but with the recent popularity of Sonic, I wouldn't be surprised if he and his brother were looking into other lines of work, though it seems electrician might not be the best fit for his skill set. This time more laughter, and some started to take a seat. Now it occurs to me, Nilsson said,
that we were just out under that big yellow sun, and some of you might prefer to be there rather than here, particularly those of you from the Arctic tundra of Minneapolis," he said, glancing at the contingent from Target. "And I will be the first to admit that I can't compete with tropical weather. So, if you would prefer to sit around the pool with a piña colada in your hand instead of sitting around here and listening to me yap away, then I encourage you to do so." He paused to allow the flock of retailers a momentary thought of paradise. "But if you decide to leave now, you're going to miss learning about the most important event in the history of video games." Kolinsky loved it. The way Nilsson and all of his employees ran through obstacle courses with a smile on their face, no matter how difficult or peculiar the challenges were. This is what Sullivan had been talking about, the good kind of crazy, and Sega personified it through and through. "So the choice is yours," Nilsson declared. "And to those of you who are going out by the pool, save me a piña colada." But there would be no tropical drinks, because everyone returned to their seats excited to hear about the next big thing. "Wonderful," Nilsson said, and then took up where he had left off. "Crooks beware," he proclaimed, describing the Home Alone game due out in November. "Kevin's back and he's got a house full of clever tactics to defend the entire neighborhood, keep the robbers on the run, and keep the gamers hollering for more." Kolinsky proudly watched Nilsson get back in the groove, introducing the Little Mermaid. "The whole family will fall hook, line, and sinker for Ariel, and as a result, you'll be reeling in the profits. X-Men, Disaster, Riddles, Muscle, and Endless Play arrive in November as the top-selling comic book comes to the Genesis. And Streets of Rage, too. This isn't some wimpy imitation. The characters are 25% bigger and 100% tougher." The longer Nilsson spoke, the more Kolinsky realized that he had been wrong earlier. There was no need to pitch a perfect game. Sega had already pitched the perfect game these past 2 years, and now he was just about continuing to throw hard. The retailers furiously scribbled notes as Nilsson took them further and further behind the curtain, their anticipation growing for what he'd called the most important event in the history of video games. Nilsson could see their minds salivating, but Nilsson continued to expertly stretch out their anticipation. "This next product needs to remain so top secret that we can't even show you what it looks like," he began, introducing NFL Sports Talk Football starring Joe Montana. "The cast is off, and in October he'll be back on the playing field. The Genesis playing field, that is." After that, Nilsson finally arrived at the moment they had all been waiting for. "Here we are, folks," he said, adopting a hushed tone. "I have the pleasure of giving you a preview of a game we're really excited about. It won't be out until 1993, but we're so proud of the graphics, sound, and control that we wanted to give you a sneak peek at the next generation of Genesis games." Kolinsky noticed retailers leaning forward in their chairs, hoping as much as he did that Sega had the goods to keep going after Nintendo. He studied Sullivan, who looked like a child about to unwrap an unexpected Christmas gift. "It's an adventure game set in the not-so-distant past, filled with puzzles, unforgettable science fiction elements, and a quest to restore order in your civilization. No, I'm not talking about a Zelda knockoff. This is something completely different." Nilsson stepped off the stage and walked into the audience, his passion so overwhelming that he wanted them to see it firsthand. "Even if you don't like to play video games, I urge you to pick up the control pad and try out this game, Dolphin, when I'm finished speaking." This was the game that Ed Annunziata had fantasized about more than a year ago, over their Italian meal during CES. "The feel of controlling this magnificent mammal," Nilsson continued, "is unlike anything you've ever experienced before. This game is the next step in video gaming." At that, he returned to the stage and played a short clip of the game. It really was unlike anything that had ever been done before. A game as smooth and beautiful as a book or album. Maybe it wouldn't be the most important event in the history of video games, but it was certainly proof that Sega had no intention of remaining second best.
When the clip finished, the retailers appeared noticeably impressed, which made what was about to happen that much more fun. "Hey, Al," Kalinske said, loud enough for all to hear.
"Don't make them wait any longer. Show them the big thing already."
Nilsson smiled. "Sure thing, boss." The performance wasn't over, which surprised the audience almost as much as the blackout had. "But wait! There's more," Nilsson said, clicking on the next slide. "Peripherals, an important part of your profit picture." Following a collective groan, he raced through descriptions of an innovative wireless remote, the Cordless Elite, an intimidating plastic bazooka, the Menacer, and a Sega Genesis cleaning system headed to stores in September. "And that," Nilsson said, sticking his notes into a folder, "is all I have to tell you today." Just then, through the ballroom doors, Sonic the Hedgehog himself entered, accompanied by Schroeder. "Okay, Sonic," Nilsson said with a pinch of feigned exasperation. "I'm sorry. I'll tell the whole world about your new game, but would you mind if I brought Madeline up here to explain why Sonic 2 is going to be the number one game of 1992 and the most important event in the history of video games?" This was the moment that Nilsson had been waiting for, where he got to finally reveal Sega's big plans for Sonic 2. But he'd have to wait a moment longer, because as he opened his mouth, Sonic received a thunderous standing ovation. The retailers were on their feet, all of them, shaking the room and causing a tiny earthquake. These people weren't even cheering for Sega's sequel plans, since Nilsson had yet to reveal the X's and O's. No, they were simply cheering for Sonic, the character, the icon, the emblem of the war against Nintendo. And after this week, the army would be much bigger and stronger, especially after what Nilsson and Schroeder had to say next. "Sonic's back and he's better than ever," Nilsson proclaimed as the lingering applause quieted down. After that, he and Schroeder launched into one of their lightning-quick Abbott and Costello-esque banter sessions. "That's right, Al, and this time he's faster. Yep, mad, and he's cooler. He's got more enemies, more levels, more attitude." On and on they went, ping-ponging superlatives, introducing Tails, and welcoming a costumed orange fox to join them on stage. But this was all an appetizer for the entree, which was Sonic Tuesday, the video game world's first-ever global launch. "The entire marketing program," Nilsson said, "is designed to build awareness for Sonic Tuesday, the street date of Sonic 2. And on that date," Schroeder explained, "the game won't just be available at retail in the U.S., but also in Europe, Japan, Australia, and the rest of the world." "Yep," Nilsson confirmed. "We're working to make Sonic Tuesday the biggest international event since the fall of the Berlin Wall." To someone outside this room, the idea of a coordinated worldwide release might have seemed interesting but irrelevant. But the point of a global launch wasn't to dazzle with concept. The point was that the concept created connection. Normally, with games released at different stores on different days, customers couldn't help but feel like these things sort of fell out of thin air. But to know the exact date that something would be arriving, to have it circled on the calendar ahead of time, gave the gift of anticipation. For kids, there's no feeling better than excitement. And for parents, there's no feeling worse than bursting that bubble, which made it every family's duty to celebrate Sonic Tuesday. It was a marketing ploy, yes, but it worked in the same self-fulfilling way as a blockbuster film did. They're not called blockbusters just because of their budgets. Rather, it's because of the event-like, don't-be-left-out way that they're marketed, which makes people rush to the theater for the opening weekend, which then makes more people rush to the theater when they hear how big that opening weekend was. The art of the blockbuster is that it popularizes something before it ever even exists. And though Sonic 2 is still months away from completion, Sonic Tuesday gave Kalinske and Company an opportunity to unleash the biggest blockbuster the video game world had ever seen. "Anyway," Schroeder said, "you probably want to know when Sonic Tuesday is. Well, right now, all I can tell you is that it'll be one of the Tuesdays in November." "Oh, come on, Mad," Nilsson pleaded. "Tell these nice buyers the date." "I can't do that," she explained. "Sonic won't let me." Actually, Sonic's creator wouldn't let her, because he himself didn't know. As the game neared completion, Naka's notorious perfectionism became even more pronounced. The game had already been pushed from October to November, and Sega of America was desperately hoping it wouldn't be postponed again. That would ruin Sonic Tuesday, the Christmas season, and Sega's plans for a new world order. "When it comes to the challenge of leading the 16-bit revolution, we're up to it," Nilsson said as he neared the end of his presentation. "But we need your help." The retailers were the conduits to the consumer, which made them gardeners capable of planting the seed. So they had to decide whether this was a garden worth growing. Did they want to bet big on Sonic 2? Cover their windows with images of Sonic and Tails? Plaster posters everywhere and hang a giant sign out front with a countdown to the game? Pre-sell the game, track those customers, and reward them with a promotional t-shirt, which would be free to buyers who pre-ordered but would cost stores $2.50 each? Most important, were they willing to alter their operational and financial procedures so that Sonic 2 could be shipped directly to each of their individual stores? This last proposition was unprecedented. Sega was asking Fortune 500 companies to bypass their long-standing distribution systems for what was literally a fly-by-night delivery. But this was the only way that Sega could ensure a coordinated global release. For this to work, it required a partnership with the people in this room. So it all boiled down to one question. Were they in or out? Ultimately, this was what Nilsson's presentation was asking, but the question wasn't posed that simply. In the tradition of Sega's good crazy spirit and the torrential punderstorm that was Sonic 2, official tagline, too fast, too cool, today, it was issued as a challenge. "I have just one question for you," Nilsson said slowly, measuring the full weight of his final words. "Are you up to it?" Chapter 30. Just Do It. Smiles widened, glasses clinked together, and inside a chic French restaurant in San Francisco, toasts were made to celebrate revolutionizing the way video games were advertised. Tom Kalinske then shot a quick happy glance at Shinobu Toyoda and Ed Volkwine, before taking a long sip of an oaky Bordeaux and savoring the significance of this dinner with Dan Wyden and David Kennedy. If someone had told him 2 years earlier that Wyden and Kennedy would be interested in becoming Sega's agency of record, Kalinske would have either laughed, rolled his eyes, or assumed that Dan and David's siblings had started their own ad shop. After all, these were the guys responsible for building the Nike brand into what it is today, coming up with the famous Just Do It tagline and iconic sneaker campaigns like Bo Knows with Bo Jackson, Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood with David Robinson, and Spike and Mike with Spike Lee and Michael Jordan. It just seemed wonderfully inconceivable that the Oregon-based agency responsible for transforming Nike into the It Sneaker Company now wanted to do the same for Sega in the video game space. But here they all were. "So, what happened next?" Wyden asked. "Come on, Tom, don't leave us in the dark. Did the retailers rise to the challenge or not?" "You tell me," Kalinske said, resuming his recap of Boca. "After the presentations, our first meeting was with Toys."
"Toys R Us," Volkwine clarified.
"Right, Toys R Us," Kalinske continued. "One of the biggest guys in the marketplace. The tastemakers, if you will."
"Also, a very close relationship with Nintendo," Toyota piped up.
"Yep. Toys and Nintendo are peas in a pod," Kalinske said. "We've got the big P himself, Charles Lazarus."
"And let me guess," Wyden asked. "He didn't accomplish all that by acting like a gunslinging risk-taker."
"Bingo," Kalinske said. "Which is why we scheduled the Toys meeting first. If they're in, then we'll know right away that this is going to happen. If not, then at least we've got 3 days in paradise to shake it off."
"Go big or go home," Kennedy said. "Gotta love it."
"So the meeting starts, and it's myself, Paul, Al, Diane, this guy," Kalinske said, nudging Toyota, "and Richard Burns, our VP of sales. First thing Mr. Lazarus wants to know is if others are on board. Now, we've all been down there a few days, so they don't know that we haven't met with anyone else yet. I'm about to tell them this, hoping that the compliment of making them our first might carry some weight, but Burns cuts me off and says that everyone is already on board, and we've been on with Japan all night to see if they can accommodate this demand. Lazarus looks around the table, each of us trotting out our best poker faces, and he says, "Looks like we don't have any choice. Count us in and make sure we get the biggest order."
"That is positively outstanding," Wyden declared.
"I can't even describe the size of the weight that fell off of my shoulders," Kalinske said. "Not only that, but Charles then goes on to instruct his people to work closely with us every step of the way so that both companies can set records with this thing. Amazing, just amazing, and yet, that wasn't even the biggest triumph at Boca."
Toyota and Volkwein crinkled their faces, unsure of what exactly their boss had in mind.
"Are you talking about the comment from Griffiths?"
"No, but that's up there too," Kalinske said, in the mood to brag and turning to Wyden and Kennedy to offer an explanation. Jeff Griffiths is the buyer from Electronics Boutique, and he said something that reinforced how he hoped everyone in the industry was feeling. Toward the end of Boca, I asked him how he felt about the event, and without the slightest hesitation, he said, "Empowered." He then said, and I quote, "After years of being lectured to by powerless drones at Nintendo, whose only apparent talent was an annoying ability to make us feel eternally beholden to them for the pitifully small allocations and onerous payment terms, we finally find ourselves sitting face to face with people willing to listen to our ideas and act on them."
"His words, not mine," Kalinske said proudly.
"Right on," Wyden said. "We're honored that you're even considering us as the guys to help you take down those drones."
"Oh, please," Kalinske said. He appreciated the humble words, but their guests from Oregon were far and away the front-runners for the account.
After months of conducting the agency review, Sega had narrowed down their list to three candidates. Wyden and Kennedy, the gods of Nike, Foot, Cohn, and Belding, the masterminds behind Levi's 501 jeans, and Goodby, Berlin, and Silverstein, a boutique agency whose biggest claim to fame was how close their office was to Sega's headquarters, a fact they emphasized often via spontaneous drop-bys. The guys at Goodby, Berlin, and Silverstein had the creative chops, no doubt, but with a limited track record in the recent departure of Andy Berlin, one of the small firm's partners, the competition for Sega's business was pretty much narrowed down to two, and in the next few weeks, both suitors would be pitching, and Kalinske would finally have the agency that would help him bring down Nintendo.
"I think your work speaks for itself," Kalinske told them, "and I honestly can't wait to see what you come up with."
"Can you give us a sneak preview?"
Volkwein added. Wyden and Kennedy glanced at each other, smiled, and shook their heads.
"Not even a hint?"
Kalinske asked, goading.
"Just a tiny little glimpse?"
"I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you," Wyden said. "And then you'd miss the presentation, so it would all kind of be for nothing."
"But I will say," Kennedy explained, "that you wanted something revolutionary, and this campaign will be your rallying cry."
This got Kalinske even more excited. He couldn't believe that it had been only a year and a half since that big presentation in Japan, where he had received approval to revamp Sega. Hiring a new ad agency and investing in a company-redefining campaign had always been the final step in Sega's makeover, and it was almost time to try to win this beauty pageant. Things were coming together even quicker than Kalinske had imagined, and not just with advertising and retailer relations, but in other spheres as well. Plans for a Sonic the Hedgehog cartoon were reaching the point of reality. Distributing Genesis games over television cable wires was almost possible, and the crown jewel of progress was an alliance with Sony. A few days after Boca, Sega of America and Sony Electronic Publishing announced an alliance to make games for the Sega CD. The power play involving these companies shook up the video game industry, and it even made waves in the mainstream press. On May 21, 1992, the New York Times ran an article by Adam Bryant that explained the crux of the deal. "The broad alliance announced yesterday calls for Sony to tap its full stable of recording artists, actors, and movies to create games for the new Sega machines, which will use compact disc technology." Although Kalinske and Olufsen had wanted this for ages, getting approval from both parent companies had been no small task. After months of respectful pleading,
A turning point came when Sega helped Sony out with an unsettling situation. In the 1980s, there had been a growing fascination with full-motion video, FMV, games. With real actors and hours of pre-recorded footage, FMV games were essentially movies where the viewer, or in this case the player, interacted with the content, i.e. shooting monsters, avoiding obstacles, in a way that dictated how the story played out. This intersection of Silicon Valley and Hollywood led many to believe that this represented the next step in the evolution of video games. One of those believers was Sony's Michael Schulhoff, who in 1990 acquired the rights to four FMV games that had originally been created for Hasbro's Nemo console, but became available when the toy maker pulled the plug on that system. His thinking was that these games, whose files were much too big for 16-bit consoles, would be perfect for Sony's CD venture with Nintendo. But when that deal fell apart, Sony was left with costly assets and no place to exploit them, until the Sega CD came into focus. This would seemingly be the right home for Sony's FMV games, but upgrading just two of the games, Night Trap and Sewer Shark, to make them playable on the Sega CD was going to cost nearly $5 million. Sony was already lukewarm on the video game industry, and not sure that it was wise to throw more money at the FMV problem. Kalinske and Toyota, however, really wants to make a partnership work, not to mention that they needed more software for the upcoming Sega CD release. Given the situation, it seemed like a no-brainer for Sega to offer to foot the bill. This would forge an alliance with Sony, and also keep Sega on the cutting edge of technology. This was a dream scenario, everything Kalinske had wanted, until he took a closer look at the games in question and realized how violent they were. By movie standards, Night Trap and Sewer Shark were no worse than a schlocky horror film, but compared to the typical video game, they may as well have been snuff films, particularly Night Trap, in which players were tasked with saving scantily clad women from a vicious flock of vampires. As Kalinske watched one of the vampires attack a defenseless girl in the shower, that pang of conscience he hoped had been vanquished returned once again louder than before. Was it really a good idea for Sega to release this kind of game? Probably not, Kalinske thought. But then was reminded of another thought that he'd had years earlier. In the tiny kitchen of Sega's old office, he'd been reading that New York Times article about Peter Main, and came to the conclusion that if Nintendo represented control, Sega must offer the freedom of choice. Neither of these games were Kalinske's cup of tea, but who was he to stand in the way of choice? And so, after he decides to get out of his own way, Kalinske, with Toyota, arranged for Sega to foot half of Sony's bill for these two games, and future FMV development costs, which ultimately helped push through an alliance between the companies. After becoming partners on this, they decided that they would divvy up the slate of FMV games, with Sega publishing some as first-party titles, and Sony publishing others under their ImageSoft label. As a courtesy, Sony gave Sega the opportunity to choose first. Well, Kalinske thought, if I've already decided to go down this road, then I may as well ride it all the way. And he selected Night Trap, which was definitely the more violent of the two, but was also the one he thought would sell better. The game would be released on October 15th, 1992, along with the launch of the Sega CD, officially marking the beginning of a relationship between Sega and Sony that Kalinske hoped would grow much deeper. For better or worse, Sega was all about choice. That was the backbone of their video game revolution, and it was why an agency like Wyden and Kennedy was excited to work for Sega. Wait, Glenn interrupted, as everyone at the table began to discuss favorite Super Bowl commercials from over the years. What is the biggest triumph? What biggest triumph? Kalinske asked. Earlier, Glenn explained, you had mentioned a sizable triumph that was neither Toys R Us nor the comment by Jeff Griffiths. Now I'm curious. Oh, that, Kalinske said with a chuckle. He put his hand on Toyota's shoulder and said, the biggest triumph of Boca was Shinobu catching a massive sailfish. Everyone at the table laughed and turned to Toyota, who nodded bashfully. How big was the fish? Wyden asked. I will show you, Toyota said, and then pulled out his wallet and showed off a photo of him proudly standing beside an enormous sailfish.
On the first day of Boca, Gary Cousin, who is the founder of Babbage's, caught a big 80-inch shellfish. To see this, I thought, wow, very amazing. But then, the next day, I got one that was an inch bigger, and it was an incredible moment.
As everyone gushed over Toyota's 81-inch sailfish, it felt like the perfect end to the evening, and the beginning of a wonderful new relationship. Except that during the conversational ride off into the sunset, a waitress came by to drop off several expensive bottles of champagne wrapped with a bow.
"What's this?" Kalinske said, delighted by the liquid generosity.
"What a nice gesture," he said, turning to his guests.
"But you know we can't let you pay for this."
Wyden and Kennedy turned to each other with a puzzled look. But before they could say anything, Kalinske picked up a note attached to the bottles.
"Well," Kalinske said after an echoing laugh, "it appears that we have an unexpected benefactor."
"Oh, yeah?"
Volkwine asked.
"And who's that?"
Kalinske answered by passing around the note, which read, "Enjoy the champagne. We eat here all the time. Sincerely, Goodby, Berlin, and Silverstein." After everyone finished laughing, Toyota asked the question on everybody's mind.
"Do you think we should drink it?"
Wyden and Kennedy both shrugged and left the decision up to their host. Kalinske reread the note and slowly shook his head. It really was a nice gesture, deserving of bonus points for cleverness. But unfortunately, a bold move and offices nearby weren't going to be enough to get Sega's account. Maybe there was a way to throw them some business for the handheld, but the upcoming ad campaign was Sega's big shot, and they couldn't afford the risk of a less experienced agency.
"I'm tempted to say no," Kalinske said, "but I can't help but think that this move demonstrates a little bit of Sega spirit, so what the hell?"
Once again, smiles widened, glasses clinked together, and a toast was made inside a chic French restaurant in San Francisco. This time, however, it was hard to take a sip and imagine anything other than Jeff Goodby smirking somewhere in the night and thinking to himself, "Just do it." Shortly after dining with Wyden and Kennedy, Kalinske and company headed to Chicago for the summer CES. With the agency pitches fast approaching and more retailers signing on for Sonic Tuesday each day, Sega went into the show with more momentum than ever before, and having already accomplished in Boca much of what would typically need to be done at CES, Sega was in the unique position of playing defense more than offense. But just because they would be playing defense didn't mean that they'd act passive. As any football fan knows, there are tons of strategies, schemes, formations, and blitz packages. With so many permutations, the key to winning on defense is all about identifying the offense's play as soon as possible and then calling the right audible to shut it down. That was exactly what Kalinske's team set out to do. But after nearly 2 days in the Windy City, all anyone heard was that Nintendo had a big announcement planned. So, Kalinske gathered the troops together in his suite at the Sheraton for an emergency meeting. "They're getting smarter," Kalinske said, shaking his head. All of Sega's top executives were crammed into the suite, as was David Rosen and Dai Sakurai, one of Nakayama's top lieutenants, someone who in the pseudo-war between SOA and SOJ, Kalinske and the others trusted. Plus, he knew the lay of the land from his very brief term as interim president of SOA.
"I hate them for it, but I definitely respect it."
"Nobody's giving me anything," Ryo said. "I just keep hearing big move over and over. What am I supposed to do with that?"
"Could it be a new Mario game?" Kalinske asked.
"That is not their style," Toyota replied. "They like to wait a few years in between the Mario titles."
"Realistically, what could it be?"
Nilsson asked, half closing his eyes, as if by doing so the answer would be psychically revealed to him.
"We should be able to figure this out," he said with frustration, upset at himself for not being able to do so.
"My money's on a theme park,"
Van Buskirk said.
"The amazingly incredible Mushroom Kingdom, complete with real-life Koopa Troopas."
"I'd welcome that," Kalinske said. "Another thing to keep them distracted."
"What about a color handheld?"
Adair suggested.
"They can't just ignore how well Game Gear is doing, can they?"
"I don't know," Burns said.
They've gotten quite good at burying their heads in the sand, haven't they? One might even call it a forte.
It must be a partnership, Glenn suggested. It's hard to imagine a world in which they don't consider our alliance with Sony to be a slap in the face. I would venture to guess that they slap back in some fashion.
I doubt it, Ryo said. They never let anyone in their sandbox.
What about a new PR agency? Sega's PR agent Brenda Lynch suggested. The Mariners' backlash had to have woken them up.
You may very well be right, Volkwein said. But with all due respect, I don't think a new PR agency qualifies as big news.
If it truly is big news, Dai Sakurai mused, then perhaps they have decided to give up on 16 bits and move on to a 32-bit system.
I like that theory, David Rosen put in. Do to us what we did to them.
Back and forth everyone went, yipping, yapping, and playfully snapping at each other. Kalinske loved the energy and enthusiasm of the team he had built. He loved that they believed in the cause and weren't afraid to act. And it was with this last part in mind that he suggested they take things into another gear. Exactly, he said. It could be anything. So we're going to have to figure this out ourselves. Does anyone object to going undercover? Nobody in the room objected. In fact, they thought it was about time. Their favorite part about working at Sega was the whatever-it-takes mentality, and the shenanigans that often came about as a result of that. There were 6 industry parties scheduled for that evening, so Kalinske broke everyone up into teams and sent them around Chicago to see what they could dig up. Adair and Van Buskirk were paired together and sent to the Electronic Arts Party, where their efforts to solve the mystery initially amounted to nothing. It wasn't that they weren't the top-notch spies they fancied themselves to be. Rather, it truly seemed as though nobody really knew what Nintendo had planned. That changed a little, however, as the night rolled on and drinks continued to be served. Finally, in tandem, Diane and Van Buskirk cornered an EA producer with close ties to Nintendo.
Come on, I know you know, Van Buskirk added.
Yeah, honestly, just tell us already, Adair added. It's almost midnight anyway. How could it possibly make a difference at this point?
Okay, the producer said. What difference does it make? He then informed them that the next day Nintendo would be dramatically dropping the price of their hardware.
Without even thanking him for the intel, off they ran into the night. They reported the news back to Kalinske, who couldn't hide his disappointment. Nintendo was dropping the price of their deluxe SNES package, bundled with Super Mario World, to $129.95, the same as Sega. In addition, they'd also be selling an SNES without any game for $99.95. The latter piece was particularly crushing. Up until this point, Sega's consistent advantage had been a lower price than Nintendo. But by tomorrow afternoon, the Big N would be stealing headlines and beginning to undo all the work that Sega had done. Shortly after midnight, everyone returned to Kalinske's suite to digest the news and brainstorm possible responses. Some were sleepy-eyed and some were clearly drunk, but they all shared a manic insomniac energy and excitement. They not only worked for Sega, but had become Sega, and took a strange, wonderful pride in doing whatever it took to help defeat Nintendo.
Thank you all for being here at this hour, Kalinske said, showing genuine gratitude. As some of you may have already heard, Nintendo is trying to outprice us. Before we even talk about a response, I want everyone to take a moment to think about how much of a thorn in their side we must really be. They refuse to acknowledge us. They treat us like second-class citizens. But it's because of us, and only us, that in the span of only 8 months, they have dropped their price nearly 50%. They may still control the market, but I'd say that counts as proof that they are no longer invincible. Though it was late, and the news about Nintendo was disappointing, the truth behind Kalinske's words filled everyone with a second wind. Look at how much they had done in such a short time. There had to be something, then, that they could do in the few hours before the announcement.
I'm going to open the floor, Kalinske said, because I want whatever we do to be done together.
What is everyone thinking?
What about leaking a story? Lynch suggested. Something about how bad finances prompted the move, company in trouble, the end is near, etc., etc.
Do we have something like that? Kalinske asked.
No, Lynch said, but we can get creative and make them waste time responding to our storyline instead of writing their own.
Hang on a second,
Burns cautioned.
Maybe this isn't as bad as it looks. They'll have a small price advantage, sure, but we've got Sonic Tuesday.
I love Sonic Tuesday more than anyone, Nilsson said. But believe me, Nintendo's move is as bad as it looks. There's only one thing we should do, and we all know it, Adair said. We need to fire back and match them. Paul, what about that idea you mentioned to me before, of selling just the Genesis without any games? Could we sell that for $99.95?
You're talking about the core system,
Ryo replied, considering her suggestion.
Yeah, that price is doable, but we both know Japan won't go for it. And even if they did, we simply don't have enough time to deliver a measured response.
Hey, Van Buskirk said, haven't any of you ever pulled an all-nighter?
You're exactly right, Kalinske said, feeling a sudden invincibility flow through his veins.
She was right, and so was Adair. Beneath the mirage of possibilities, Sega really had only one option. And in no way was this option ideal, because it meant somehow cramming weeks of work into a single, pressure-packed night. But if Sega wished to really become the company that deserved to decapitate Nintendo, that would revolutionize video games, that was worthy of working with an agency like Wyden and Kennedy, then they really had no choice but to suck it up, find the fun, and just do it.
Let's do it, Kalinske said. Come on, we need this. We're on the brink of something here, and we really need this. So it's simple. Let's make this happen.
And just like that, everyone was flooded with energy and ready to work through the night. But in order to get to work, they needed something bigger than a hotel room, preferably something with some form of technology to help them pull this off. The hotel had a business center, but it was closed at this hour, or it was closed until Adair found a way to break in and temporarily turn the place into Sega's workshop. They figured out the logistics, developed the strategy, and designed the necessary materials for the presentation that morning that would cut Nintendo off at the knees. Beside the time crunch, the hardest part of pulling this off was that they had to make it appear completely pre-planned. More deadly than being upstaged by Nintendo was the allegation of being reactionary. Everything that they prepared this evening had to look, sound, and feel like it had been planned out for months. Although that wasn't factually true, emotionally it sort of was. The crux of Sega's philosophy hinged on instant adaptability, the art of embracing opportunities in the blink of an eye. So although they only had hours to create something from scratch instead of months, if anyone could do it, it was these guys. And they did. Finally crafting all of the following materials before the pre-show sales meeting in the morning. 200 press kits, updated fall-winter price lists, comprehensive sell sheets for the new $99 core system, price stickers and display photos to adorn Sega's booth, updated pocket cheat sheets for Sega's internal sales force, talking points for everyone to tell the press, retailers, third parties, etc. The impossible task of putting together an entire campaign in one night was the easy part compared to changing Nakayama's mind. Luckily, for that task, Kalinske got help from Rosen and Sakurai. All through the night, they strategized about which buttons to push and how hard to push them. At last, they took the request to Nakayama, bracing themselves for that pivotal now-or-nothing moment.
"You're being impulsive," Nakayama said.
He felt strongly that this would be something they would regret in the morning.
"Not at all. We've actually been considering this for quite some time and had all the materials ready just in case," Kalinske said, speaking quickly so as not to get caught in a lie.
It was true that Sega of America had been seriously considering a cheaper, game-free system, though not one at $99.95, but Nakayama didn't need to know that.
"Please, trust me," Kalinske pleaded. "Remember, you hired me to make decisions like this."
There was a long pause. "It's the logical move," Kalinske continued. "If not now, then we'll do this in 6 months. But what 6 months of some additional profits compared to all the sales we'll make by doing this now and taking Nintendo down in the process?" And then a longer pause.
Kalinske looked at Ryo and Toyota, his brothers in arms, then glanced over their shoulders at Nilsson, Adair, Van Buskirk, and the rest of his devoted employees. This had to work out. They just had to be given permission to try to pull off this miracle. Finally, Nakayama broke the silence.
Okay, Tom. If you think this is best.
As soon as the line went dead, the team erupted with joy. In just a few hours, they would return to being serious, focused, business suit-wearing executives. In just a few hours, they would match blows with Nintendo and look for new and unexpected ways